1 Kings chapter 2. Tonight I'd like to share with you some devotional thoughts on things that you can know for sure, certainly. Some of them are rather obvious. And some of the things that we are certain about indeed do color the way in which we live, the priorities that we have and the choices that we make. A couple of illustrations that I have here in the Old Testament just to set the tone. In 1 Kings chapter 2 and verse number 36, the king sent and called for Shimei and said to him, "Build thee a house in Jerusalem and dwell there, and go not forth thence anywhere. Build your house in Jerusalem, stay in Jerusalem." Verse 37, "For it shall be that on the day thou goest out and passest over the brook Kidron, thou shalt know for certain that thou shalt surely die. Thy blood shall be upon thine own head." Please notice what he told them. Thou shalt know for certain that thou wilt surely die. And so he said to the king, verse 38, "The saying is good." He understood. "As my lord the king hath said, so will thy servant do. So he dwelt there many days. 3 years come and go. And for whatever reason, a memory lapse perhaps, verse 40 says that he arose, saddled up, and left town. Solomon discovered that according to verse 41, and notice what he says in verse 42. "The king sent and called for Shimei and said unto him, Did I not make thee to swear by the Lord and protested," literally warned you, "saying, know for a certain, on the day thou goest out and walkest abroad anywhither, that thou shalt surely die. And thou saidest unto me, thy word that I have heard is good." Well, the man was put to death. Those are the consequences. He knew for certain that the moment that he would disobey the king's command to remain in Jerusalem, he would die. Yet knowing that, in spite of knowing that, he left anyway. Now, keep that logged in your hard drive. Go to Jeremiah chapter 26. Jeremiah 26. Jeremiah makes this statement in verse number 15. "But know ye for certain," there's that word again, "know ye for certain that if you put me to death, you shall surely bring innocent blood upon yourselves and upon this city and upon the inhabitants thereof. For of a truth the Lord hath sent me unto you to speak all these words in your ears." Now you fast forward, and chapter 36, same book. Chapter 36. And would you look please at verse number 29. "Thou shalt say to Jehoiakim, king of Judah, thus saith the Lord, thou hast burned this roll, saying, why hast thou written therein, saying, the king of Babylon shall certainly come and destroy this land, and shall cause to cease from thence man and beast. All the king is doing is rehearsing what Jeremiah said to him. And in fact, the king would come and sack the city. Now look over in Daniel chapter 11. Daniel chapter 11. Now in prophecy we understand that there was a near meaning and there is a yet to be fulfilled meaning. In fact, what Jeremiah said came to pass at a point in time in ancient history. Prophetically speaking, there will come the prophetic conqueror back to the Holy Land and do the same thing. Daniel implies here in the 11th chapter, the 13th verse, in a broader spectrum of teaching, says, "For the king of the north shall return and shall set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and with much riches." You might understand this as the obvious, that where these words have appeared in these three different places, it carries the idea of absolutely will occur, or something that is absolute, indisputable, incontrovertible. It's going to be. Now, in the same sense as that, you and I would understand this by something that the writer of Proverbs said. Let me read to you a verse that I'm sure some of you are familiar with, in the 23rd chapter of Proverbs, and the 5th verse. "Wilt thou set thine eyes upon that which is not? For riches certainly," there's the word again, "certainly make themselves wings. They fly away as an eagle toward heaven." Riches fly, certainly. Okay, so not something you really want to count on, because one thing is true, that if it is at all possible, riches can evaporate, and that rather quickly. And then there's the comment of the centurion there in Luke's Gospel, chapter 23, when he made this comment. In Luke 23:47 about Jesus, he said, "Certainly, this was a righteous man." Absolutely. There is absolutely no doubt in the centurion's mind that the person he was looking at was a righteous man. Now, something that we want to address this way. Remember I said to you that when you see the word certain or certainly, and you put it in its context, whatever is prescribed there certainly or absolutely will come to pass. Now, the scriptures teach us, and this applies to every person in the room, that it is appointed unto man once to die. All right, that's an absolute truth. Now, there is only a single exception to that. Only a single exception. There is the possibility that God would grant us mercy should the rapture occur before our appointed time. God knows, we don't. But with that said, there is something to be considered with regard to establishing priorities. Look in 1 Timothy chapter 6, please. In light of what the writer of Proverbs said about riches certainly fly, in 1 Timothy chapter 6, and the 6th verse, 6:6, "But godliness with contentment is great gain." Then the next verse says this, a certainty. As you and I make, the steps of a good man are ordered by the Lord, as we continue in our steps toward eternity, you got to know that in verse 7, there's nothing that you have in your pocket now that you're going to carry with you. The verse says, "For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out." Now the word "certain" here has a deeper brush or deeper color in it. It means something that is absolutely crystal clear. Crystal clear. So when you look at this, we can say that it is clear that when we come to our appointed end, there's nothing that we have by way of possession that we're carrying with us. Nothing. Absolute. Now that's a certainty. That word certainly means crystal clear, but it is obvious, it is evident, and is indisputable. There's nothing that we own that we're carrying out. Now think about this, and it's a good practical tool in Bible study when you're doing this at your kitchen table or wherever it is you study your Bible. After you read a verse and you look at that for a little bit, write down on your study sheet these two words, "so what?" And think about it. So we look at verse number 7. We brought nothing into this world, and it is certain, absolutely crystal clear, we can carry nothing out. And I say, well, so what? What are the implications or the ramifications of the truth of that verse? And it is true. You may, like all prudent stewards do, Christian people and unsaved alike, you have, during the course of your life, gathered more or less certain assets. They may be monetary. They may be tucked away in a bank in some kind of a stocks or bonds or money markets and all kind of things. Or you may just have cash under your mattress. You may have jewels, and you may have gold bullion or silver coins somewhere. Or you just maybe tie all your fortune up in real estate. Or, you know, other people, if they were to sit down and write a list of the things to come up with some kind of a profile of their net worth, they would include, you know, two or three sports cars, a yacht, a summer home, a winter haven, and their regular home. And then they would go in their house and they start writing down their paintings that they have all over the house, or their different things that people gather. And then there's the guy or the family that has but little. And I think of the widow in the New Testament, didn't have much. And of course, accounting for her is a whole lot easier than for the other guys, is it not? And would you say that the anxiety level for her is a whole lot less than the other guys? Because, you know, it's a truth in the scripture too about the degree of grief that the possession of things bring into the life of an individual. You're always worrying, looking over your shoulder. And if you have an excessive amount of things tied up in the market, you're looking at the Wall Street Journal every day, and you're checking all of your stuff and to see where it's at. Do I buy? Do I sell? Do I put into the money? Or what do I do? Who's got time? You've got to know this. With all that said, and listen, every Christian steward knows that there's nothing sinful about gathering a little bit to leave and take care of your spouse should you predecease her, or for your children or your grandchildren, whatever you want to do in your kind heart. But with all that said, it is certain that you can carry nothing out. Nothing. Not one thing. So you come back to that Bible study question, so what? Well, so what means, in light of that truth, how do I live now? I'm not dead yet. Okay? I don't know when, maybe tomorrow. But how do I live now? Godliness with contentment is great gain. Even if you are a wise investor and your particular stock over the last quarter yielded a 40% increase. It still doesn't outdistance the gain that godliness coupled with contentment brings. Now, the opposite of contentment, as we will find in the scriptures, is covetousness. Okay? Contentment and covetousness are poles apart. It is certain, however, that we can carry nothing out, can take nothing with us. I want you to look with me at Luke 12 for just a second. Luke 12. Famous little passage. It would be an interesting study if you should take the time to do this passage. If ever you want to find a lockdown profile of a self-centered person, you find it right here between verses 13 and 21. And a little bit of a careful study would reveal that there are numerous instances where the individual refers to himself maybe a dozen times. He addresses himself a few more times. But it's clear from the language that you find in these scant few verses the amount of times that the individual comes to the surface. Now, when you look at this, and of course the caution is in verse 15, take heed and beware of covetousness, for a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things. Those are the things that you can't carry out. Now, this guy has a lot of things. And in the parable, of course, the ground of a certain rich man brought forth plentifully. He didn't need prayer requests for rain, Dan. He had good crop yield. He thought within himself, saying, what shall I do? I have no room to bestow my fruits. So he said, this will I do. I will put down my barns and build greater, and there will I bestow all my fruits and my goods, and so on and so forth. And he said, I will say to my soul, he's talking out to himself, soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years. Take thine ease. Eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, thou fool. Now, interesting word is the fool. You know, the Bible cautions us about looking at another person and calling them a fool. Literally a moron. Be very cautious about that. But as I am taught here, This word that the Lord uses in verse 20 is a different kind of a word. It's a different word altogether. The same word that moron comes from. It actually comes from a root word that means to foam out. And the idea is insanity. It's a different word that we get from insanity. Thou fool. Thou fool. You know, when you think about moron, stupid, this word aphron carries the notion of insanity. It comes from a root that means to foam up. So here's what he's saying. God said to him, you're insane. This night, thy soul shall be required of thee. Then whose shall those things be which thou hast provided? Now be certain, you can carry nothing out. In the discourse between the rich man and Lazarus, how much of the rich man's portfolio did he take with him to hell? Did he take enough to buy himself out? Did not. Didn't take anything there. And so the lesson is, if a person thinks that life is to be spent in the pursuit of the acquisition and the accumulation of things. He's insane because he can't carry any of them out. So what? I write on the bottom of it, so what? What's the application of that to me and you, the Christian steward? So what? Well, verse 21 says, so is he that layeth up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. Then you go on further there, and of course, to be wealthy in God's eyes is to first seek his kingdom, and God will add all the things necessary to your life to you. There's real wealth from an eternal perspective. There's a person who's rich toward God when they first set their heart on him and seek him. Can't carry anything out, though. For where your heart is, where your treasure is, there will your heart be. Now, if things are your treasure, you're insane. If God is your treasure, you are wealthy beyond calculation. Simple as that. Now, when you think about this whole thing, it's crystal clear that whenever we make those sad trips to the funeral parlor to pay our respects to a family of a departed loved one, no matter how pleasant a face the undertaker tries to put on the situation, it is absolutely deplorable when you realize that a person may have, and I've seen this a couple times, a person may have during their life lived not lavishly but comfortably and have accumulated things that were reasonable and necessary, and they didn't lack for a thing all their lives. And when they come to the end of it all, they had to sacrifice it and forfeit and sell it off so that they can spend their last pitiful few months of existence in a home at a rate of about $7,000 a month at minimum. And at the end of their day, they were left with nothing. Had nothing. Things are not an end in of themselves, but are the means to get us to the end. But never should things be placed on a pedestal as though they would be our deliverance. There is no amount of treasure that we can ever accumulate that will ever stand us good in God's stead, except one thing, the precious, inestimable, precious blood of Christ that's redeemed our souls. So what? You can know things certainly. One or two final verses, 2 Timothy 1:12. Second Timothy, things you can know for sure. Paul wants us to know that that there are legitimate sufferings that Christian people certainly will endure, and yet. He says in verse 12, 2 Timothy 1:12, nevertheless, I am not ashamed. Now there he is sitting in a prison cell again, second time around. I'm not ashamed. For I know, there's a certainty there, I know whom I have believed and am persuaded that he is able to keep that which I have committed unto him against that day. I know. Absolutely, it is crystal clear that he is able to keep me. And then 1 John chapter 5 and verse 13. First John chapter 5. Verse 13. These things have I written unto you, that believe on the name of the Son of God, that you may know absolutely with all clarity, that you may know that you have eternal life and that you may believe on the name of the Son of God. There are certain things you can know for sure. There's no doubt. It's absolute truth. And so I come back and I challenge you with this again. Paul tells Timothy, it is certain that you can carry nothing out. Therefore, the instruction is this: godliness with contentment, whether anything else is added to the equation or not, godliness with contentment is great gain. Great gain. Nothing else will accompany you to glory except that vital godliness imputed to you through the righteousness and the death of Christ. That's the only thing you take on the other side. Nothing else makes any difference. I leave some things unsaid that probably wouldn't make any difference tonight anyway, but take that for whatever it's worth and however useful it may be to you.